Welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices from today's Arizona Republic: Janet Miller, age 83, from Chandler, and Napoleon Pisano Jr., 79, from Mesa. And we'll turn now to the business section of today's Arizona Republic. The top of the page headline: Lockheed expands naval defense portfolio. Lockheed Martin will buy naval defense company Ultra Maritime from private equity firm Advent for $3.45 billion, bolstering its portfolio as global demand for military technology surges. After the closing of the deal, announced on July 7th, Ultra Maritime will become a part of Lockheed's Rotary and Mission Systems, which reported revenue of $17.3 billion in 2025 and employs 35,000 people worldwide. Sustained conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East and President Donald Trump's $1.5 trillion defense budget request for 2027 are driving up demand for weapons and military technology, pushing defense contractors to expand their capabilities. Ultra Maritime, specializing in anti-submarine warfare and undersea defense technologies, is a part of Cobham Ultra, created after Advent acquired British aerospace company Cobham in 2020 and then combined it with Ultra Electronics following its 2022 takeover. Lockheed said Ultra Maritime's international presence and a portfolio of exportable anti-submarine warfare technologies, including naval sonar sensing systems, will complement and expand its existing sonar solutions. Earlier this year, Ultra Maritime received a development contract from the U.S. Navy for its underwater acoustic decoy, designed to protect ships or submarines from torpedoes. In 2025, Ultra Maritime announced a partnership with Anduril Industries to advance autonomous ocean sensing and General Atomics Aeronautical Systems to develop unmanned airborne anti-submarine warfare capabilities. And the next headline in this section: Microsoft plans to eliminate 4,800 jobs. Company set to launch overhaul of the Xbox unit. Microsoft said on July 6th that it would cut 4,800 jobs, or about 2.1% of its global workforce, overhauling its Xbox gaming business and divesting up to five studios as it looks to boost returns after years of heavy investment in the division. The restructuring will involve 3,200 job cuts, including laying off 1,600 employees on July 6th. Despite spending tens of billions of dollars to expand Xbox, including its acquisition of Activision Blizzard, Microsoft has struggled to narrow the gap with Sony's PlayStation and Nintendo, prompting a broader rethinking of the gaming business. The company has increasingly shifted its strategy toward distributing its games across more platforms rather than relying on console-exclusive titles to drive Xbox hardware sales. The Xbox restructuring will involve divestment of four studios. Xbox's new head, Asha Sharma, said in a note to employees, South Midnight producer Compulsion Games and Psychonauts maker Double Fine Productions will become independent studios, while Ninja Theory and Undead Labs will be spun off to grow Senua and State of Decay 3, Sharma said. The management of Arkane Studios, which developed Dishonored and is currently working on a game based on Marvel Comics character Blade, has started consultations with its workers' union in France to review the options, she added. Big Tech's historic AI outlays, set to top $700 billion this year, are piling pressure on companies to show returns from the technology and offset the rising cost of rolling it out across their businesses. Amazon and Meta platforms have also laid off thousands of employees this year. Chief People Officer Amy Coleman, however, told employees in a memo that roles eliminated today are not being replaced by AI. At the same time, she said, what is true is that AI is changing how work gets done. That targeted cuts makes the announcement read more like portfolio reallocation and operating discipline than a fresh catalyst for the stock, said Parthas Talancia, CEO of Equisites Research. In the near term, the market is likely to reward Microsoft less for headcount reductions and more for evidence that AI monetization is scaling faster than AI-related costs. The company's shares were down 14% on July 6th, following a nearly 23% slump in its shares in the first 6 months of 2026, their worst first-half performance since 2022. The software giant earlier this year offered voluntary buyouts to about 7% of its U.S. workforce, or about 9,000 employees. Microsoft often trims jobs near the end of its fiscal year in June as it sets spending plans for the new year. Microsoft has been managing down its workforce in order to pay for its AI investments, said Gil Luria, managing director of D.A. Davidson. Continuing with the business section, EU state report warns of Russian banking strains. 27-nation bloc readies new raft of sanctions. This was written by John Irish and John O'Donnell from Reuters. Russia risks an explosive banking crisis because lenders are shouldering much of the burden of the country's war economy, a European state intelligence report seen by Reuters has warned, as the European Union readies a raft of new sanctions. The two-page document, which was prepared in recent weeks to inform European officials about the state of Russia's banks, outlines their vulnerability to further Western curbs. While Russia's banks have mostly weathered the sanctions imposed since Moscow's 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the June report says deteriorating loans and growing household indebtedness create an explosive risk, just as the EU prepares a 21st package of sanctions it hopes to finalize in July, targeting banks and cryptocurrency networks. The Russian Central Bank declined to comment on the assessment, although it has recently played down the risks of major banking crisis. With the cost of a four-year war with Ukraine draining state coffers, Russia has increasingly leaned on banks to support companies and borrowers. The report says this has lumbered banks with risks as the economy teeters. The economy ministry cut its gross domestic product growth forecast to 0.4% in 2026, to 1.3% previously, and to 1.4% in 2027 from 2.8%. The intelligence report, titled Note on the Probability of a Banking Crisis in Russia in 2026, said banks have been pushed to give subsidized loans to defense companies, home buyers, and others. Noted that state-backed credit programs, loan restructurings, and government support masked the bank's vulnerability. The situation creates the illusion of a dynamic economy that in reality conceals an explosive situation, which an economic shock, such as an ambitious package of sanctions against banks, could trigger, said the report. Lending to defense firms, regional state-backed projects, and homeowners has increased the amount of loans that may never be repaid, the author said. The report estimates that 10% of corporate loans are doubtful, a sharp increase from 2024, while some major banks reported retail non-performing loan ratios as high as 15% in 2025. It also says that more than 500,000 Russians declared bankruptcy in 2025. That's up almost a third from the previous year, while state programs encouraged more than 13 million Russians to take out at least three loans simultaneously. Russian Central Bank Deputy Governor Philip Gabunia said last month that vulnerabilities in the financial sector are not critical, stressing that banks' capital cushion was the highest level in 3 years, while corporate bad loans had, at 4%, not changed during the last year and a half. Russia's economy is stagnating, but the dominance of the state in defense spending means there's no immediate financial crisis to hand, said Chris Weaver, a Russia expert at consultancy Marco Advisory. Asia ignores sanctions, so the idea that a fresh round will tip Russia into crisis is wishful thinking, he added. He added that defense spending was keeping unemployment low and wages high. The European Union has imposed sweeping sanctions on Russia in an attempt to choke bank profits and international money movements, oil and gas sales, and the defense sector. Russia has struggled but proven largely resilient, while Europe has often had difficulty enforcing sanctions with no central authority to do so. Compounding Europe's difficulties, the United States, under President Donald Trump, has loosened some sanctions, earlier granting temporary permission to sell Russian oil, although that waiver expired in mid-June. European diplomats are now discussing the targeting banks and cryptocurrency networks, as well as drone production, oil traders, and refiners. This would add scores of individuals and entities to the sanctions list, including nearly 90 banks, bringing the number of blackballed lenders to more than 100, over half of the country's internationally connected banks. Russian President Vladimir Putin recently said Russia would press ahead with its battlefield aim of fully capturing four Ukrainian regions, despite the sanctions, rejecting what he said was a new proposal by Ukraine to rein in hostilities. Putin also said Russia was expecting a resumption of U.S.-led diplomatic efforts to end the war once the hot phase of the U.S.-Israeli conflict with Iran was resolved. There are signs of increasing pressure. Russia's second-largest lender, VTB, plans to boost reserves. Its first deputy CEO told Reuters on July 3rd to shield itself against higher fuel prices and possible loans. The amount of cash being held outside banks has grown by more than 17% year on year to over $243 billion so far this year, according to central bank data. That has put pressure on banks which rely on deposits to fund lending. All major banks are already under sanctions, and when they were introduced in 2022, there was stress. Taras Skvortsov, chief financial officer of Russia's largest bank, Sberbank, told Reuters, "By 2026, everyone has become so used to it. Many clients of the sanctioned banks do not even know about sanctions," he said. The electricity was off the charts. Drums were beating. Red, white, and blue smoke filled the Seattle streets. Decibels skyrocketed. Enter Sandman, Free Bird, and Take Me Home, Country Roads had the patriotic juices flowing like 4th of July was a weekend holiday. From Pike Place Market to Lumen Field, July 6th was a full-on party in Seattle. United States men's national team supporters partied and readied for the next major step in its soccer growth. Whether it was a longtime supporter or hopping on the bandwagon, everyone was all in on it. The renewed American dream of World Cup glory, all happening right at home. It wasn't long for that dream to turn into a nightmare, and one an entire nation couldn't escape. "Today wasn't a good day," said midfielder Tyler Adams. What was on the cusp of happening quickly turned into what could have been, with Belgium playing the bogeyman for millions of Americans that dared to fantasize about the U.S. becoming the next major player in soccer by eliminating the host nation in the round of 16 with a dominant 4-1 victory. There. It took only 120 seconds for Belgium to put pressure on the American defense, and although it didn't result in a score, there was a noticeable shift in the atmosphere, like a, "Oh, this is serious" vibe. Belgium only needed 7 more minutes to affirm that thought, when Charles de Ketelaere turned the entire U.S. defense into an additional 11 spectators that just watched the Red Devils toy with the home team and kick all of that enthusiasm right out of the stadium. "We really started in a poor way," said coach Mauricio Pochettino. You could feel the instant energy shift after Belgium's first goal. Thousands of people suddenly stunned. Home teams give up the score of a game all the time. It hardly results in a team getting rattled immediately. This, however, was different. Belgium was tactically dominating the U.S. from the get-go. It was like the defense getting three straight sacks to force a punt, then the running back plowing over the star linebacker before the quarterback delivered a dot to an open receiver. Just about what Belgium wanted to do, the U.S. was forced to succumb. Then there was the glimmer of hope. Malik Tillman brought the jolt with another perfectly placed free kick to tie it up at 1-1. The energy is back. Here come the Americans and the dream still alive. All for just 61 seconds. When DeCatelier and company made all of the U.S. team look silly to retake the lead and suck the life out of the field once again. The roughly final hour of action was just the U.S. and its fans desperately trying to find an ounce of juice, something, if anything, to bring the excitement back, grasping at straws to not let the dream fade away. Instead, it went into true nightmare fashion in the second half when absolutely nothing went right. A major howler from goalkeeper Matt Fries put Belgium up 3-1 and cemented that there would be no happy ending coming from this Romelu Lukaku rubbed more salt in the wound in the third minute of stoppage time, just in case the night wasn't torturous enough. "We did press. We put them in some difficulties," said Belgium coach Rudy Garcia. "The goalkeeper might have made a mistake because we pushed him to." Belgium's pure dominance from the jump threw U.S. team entirely off its game and giving it a taste of its own medicine. What made the U.S. so successful through the round of 32 was how quickly the attack formed and succeeded, scoring first in all four matches and doing it in the first half. Then, in one of its most important matches in history, the U.S. never held the lead. "We didn't see much of the pressing, the aggression, the passion that we saw in previous games," said Captain Tim Ream. A lot can be made about how much of a disappointment this match was for the U.S., and a nation on the brink of a soccer breakthrough. But it's not like it was entirely self-inflicted. Belgium came into the tournament ranked in the top 10, and after a sluggish start to the tournament, found its rhythm just in time to power it to a third quarterfinal appearance in the past four World Cups. That momentum just made for a brilliant display that the U.S. was unsure exactly how everything fell apart. "We gave them good chances or even half chances, and they finished them," Adams said. "It was just a little bit too easy today. Confusion for one side and plenty to be happy about for another." "We are highly satisfied tonight," Garcia said. For nearly 4 weeks, the U.S. team had a nation tucked into its red, white, and blue covers, counting all the sheep that would be able to hoist a World Cup trophy in the great American dream. All just for the Red Devils of Belgium to spoil it all with a nightmare that will surely keep the U.S. sleepless in Seattle. And turning to baseball, Fott and Kepler helped D-backs dust the Padres. Since returning from the minor leagues last week, Diamondbacks right-hander Brandon Fott has looked in many ways like his vintage self, pumping strikes, mixing pitches, logging innings, all of which he did for the second consecutive start in an 8-0 win over the San Diego Padres on Monday night, July 6th at Petco Park. In other ways, he has looked entirely different. When he was a kid, Fott started going over his head with his pitching delivery, an old-school mechanical quirk he brought with him to the big leagues. Since returning from the minors, however, Fott has ditched that part of his windup. It had worked. He has no plans to bring it back. "I think just less moving parts," he said, after firing five scoreless innings against the Padres while building his pitch count to 72. "The arm has been more on time, everything coming out well without it. Kind of one of those things where we don't have to do that if things are still feeling good." Everything felt good for the Diamondbacks on Monday. Max Kepler drove in four runs and connected on his first home run with his new team, Geraldo Perdomo and Nolan Arenado each added a solo shot. And the Diamondbacks were victorious in the first game of a seven-game stretch, leading into the All-Star break, a portion of their schedule that could help define their direction heading into next month's trade deadline. Better still, they won a game against a club they appear to be competing against for the third wildcard spot, and a club that is struggling even worse than they are. With the win, the Diamondbacks moved back to the 500 mark at 45-45. The Padres dropped to 44-46, losing for the ninth time in their past 10 games. A day earlier, right fielder Corbin Carroll talked about the need to start playing better baseball before it's too late. That is, before the front office decides buying might not be prudent. Carroll wanted to see the team strike a balance between playing with urgency and not forcing things. They seemed to find that middle ground against the Padres. The Diamondbacks scored twice in the first, thanks in part to a pair of defensive mistakes. They added four more in the third, with Kepler's three-run homer capping a string of four consecutive hits off Buehler. Perdomo and Arenado homered in the fourth and sixth innings, respectively. Fott took it from there. Across five innings, he allowed just four hits, walked none, and struck out six. He elicited nine whiffs, getting at least one whiff on four of his six pitch types. Fott said when he was 9 years old when he first decided to start his delivery with his pitching hand and glove together over his head. He doesn't know why he did it, but he never stopped, not until he was sent down last month. "My first start in Reno was the first time I didn't go over my head in my whole life," he said. "Surprisingly, I felt good, and I'm sticking with it." But he said the biggest change since coming back to the majors has been in his mentality. "When he has been at his best in the majors, he has been a pitcher who relentlessly attacks the strike zone. Sometimes his aggressiveness can work against him, but even then, it usually allows him to be economical and pitch deep into games." It was an approach, he said, that got away from him earlier this season. "Getting back to that," he said, "and making it a priority is the key. And we see that it's working, so we'll keep doing it." In two starts since returning from Reno, Fott has allowed just one run in 10 and a third innings, with one walk and eight strikeouts. Manager Torey Lovello said Fott has been exuding confidence. "You can feel it," he said, adding, "I think he's doing everything with conviction." At a time when the Diamondbacks are working to get Merrill Kelly and Zach Gallen back on track and biding time until right-hander Michael Soroka is healthy, Fott can make a huge impact if he can continue to pitch effectively. "We know what he's capable of doing," Lovello said. "He's rattled off a lot of really consistent outings in the past and taken a lot of pressure off the bullpen. That's what it would do. It would keep us in games, stretch things out so we don't have to use bullpen pieces, and add some stability in an area where I think we need it badly." With less than a week to go before the draft, the Diamondbacks scouting and front office groups began hunkering down at Chase Field on Monday, July 6th, trying to line up their board. Though the top three picks are widely expected to be, in some order, UCLA shortstop and Chandler native Roch Chalowski, Texas prep shortstop Grady Emerson, and Georgia Tech catcher Vaughn Lackey, the consensus seems to be that, beyond that, just about anything can happen once the draft begins on Saturday morning, July 11th. That is to say, a player whom some teams might value in the top 10 might be seen by other organizations as fitting better at the back half of the first round. "Yes, I would agree with that," Diamondbacks scouting director Ian Rebin said. "Everybody is kind of talking about that. I think there's a ton of separation. I think that's a testament to the depth. I kind of view it as an opportunity. We get to hunt the players we really like and value and stick to our process and stay disciplined to it. I think it should work out pretty good." The Diamondbacks' first pick is at number 15 overall. They also own a competitive balance round A pick at number 31 and their second rounder at number 53. "It's pretty exciting," Rebin said. "And I do think there's a lot of depth, really, in all demographics. The college group, both hitting and pitching, and the high school side, I think there's a lot of interesting players." The depth of it is what's exciting to us in being able to bring in a wide variety of impact players and get multiple of them. The Diamondbacks' prospect pipeline continues to skew more toward position players than pitchers, but Rebin did not suggest that the club is any more likely to use its top selection on an arm than it has been in recent years. "I think no matter what, we're looking for the best available player," he said. "If that ends up being an arm, we're going to be super excited that we're getting a high-impact major league starter. We're totally open to it. You're always looking at the best player." And the Diamondbacks reinstated catcher James McCann from the injured list on Monday, July 6th, making room on the roster by optioning catcher Adrian Del Castillo to AAA Reno. McCann has been on the 10-day injured list since May 19th with a strained right quad. He played three games in AAA Reno on a rehab assignment, going 0 for 12 with two strikeouts. McCann was hitting .203, .217, .254 in 59 at-bats at the time of his injury. He was coming off a productive 2025 season in which he hit .260, .324, .431 with five homers in 41 games. Del Castillo delivered a key three-run homer in the Diamondbacks' 4-3 win over the Milwaukee Brewers on Saturday, July 4th, but he struggled mightily to get going at the plate this year. He missed all of spring training with a calf injury, then played only sparingly at AAA Reno before being summoned to the majors in early April. In 151 at-bats, Del Castillo hit just .185, .244, .311 with five homers. And the Diamondbacks play tonight at 6:40 p.m. on Cox Channel 34. They'll be in San Diego at Petco Park. Cabrera gave up three runs in 3 1/3 innings against the Brewers on Friday, July 3rd, his second consecutive shaky outing since his impressive debut on June 21st versus the Twins, in which he fired five-plus scoreless innings. King has been far and away the Padres' best starting pitcher, already logging 102 1/3 innings through 18 starts. King gave up two runs in six innings against the Dodgers in his most recent start. He also gave up two runs in six innings in his lone start against the Diamondbacks this year, an outing that occurred on April 26th in Mexico City. And coming up, there's a game Thursday, July the 9th at San Diego at 6:40. Merrill Kelly will be pitching versus the Padres' Griffin Canning. And on Friday, July 10th, they'll be in Los Angeles. Diamondbacks left-handed pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez versus Dodgers right-handed pitcher Shohei Ohtani. And Saturday, July 11th, also at LA, Diamondbacks right-handed pitcher Brandon Pfaadt versus Dodgers right-handed pitcher Yoshinobu Yamamoto. And some football news before we leave the sports section. Cam Scataboo gets rave review from Harbaugh. Cam Scataboo might not be at the top of your fantasy draft list when it comes to NFL running backs, but it sounds like his new head coach is sold on what the former Arizona State standout can offer in 2026. Scataboo, who scored seven touchdowns in eight games last season before suffering a season-ending ankle injury as a rookie, is expected to be a full participant when veterans report to the New York Giants training camp on Tuesday, July 28th. When he does, Coach John Harbaugh said he expects Scataboo to be a top-tier talent and pick up right where he was last year. "I thought he was just what you saw, a downhill runner, a tone-setter type runner," said Harbaugh, the former longtime head coach of the Baltimore Ravens, meeting with reporters on Monday, July 6th. "He's a tough tackle. That's what you look for. How many guys can make yards when they're not supposed to make yards on their own? It seems to me he was that kind of guy at Arizona State, and the exact same guy that I saw on tape last year. You guys know better. You watched him up close and personal. He's a top-tier back, and he's planning on playing that way this year." Scataboo, a fourth-round draft pick, rushed for 410 yards on 101 carries and caught 24 passes for 207 yards last season as a rookie for the Giants before suffering an ankle injury on October 26th in a 38-20 loss to the Philadelphia Eagles. He finished his senior season at Arizona State with 1,711 rushing yards and 21 touchdowns, along with 45 receptions for 605 yards and three more scores. He set the school record for most rushing yards in a season and became the first ASU player to amass 2,000 yards from scrimmage in a single season. He also finished fifth in voting for the Heisman Trophy. And some sports briefs. IOC provisionally lifts ban on Russian Olympic Committee. The International Olympic Committee provisionally lifted its ban on the Russian Olympic Committee on Tuesday, paving the way for a return to international competitions, including the Los Angeles 2028 Olympics. The IOC said its executive board had decided to provisionally end the suspension in place since 2023, but there is no decision yet on whether Russia could display its flag colors and anthem at the Olympic Games. Russians competed as neutrals at the 2024 Paris Olympics and at the 2026 Milano Cortina Winter Games. And all NBA star guard Donovan Mitchell has agreed on a four-year, $273 million maximum contract extension with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Mitchell's representation, Creative Artists Agency, known as CAA, confirmed the details Tuesday morning with ESPN. The deal also includes a player option for the 2030-31 season and a full trade kicker. This marks the second extension for Mitchell since he arrived in Cleveland in 2022. Mitchell, who's 29, averaged 27.9 points, 5.7 assists, and 4.5 rebounds in 70 games, all starts, in 2025-26. He was named to the All-Star Game for the seventh straight season, including all 4 years with Cleveland. And three-time NBA Most Valuable Player Nikola Jokic told reporters in his native Serbia that he wants to be a Denver Nugget for life, but he's not rushing into a contract extension this offseason. "My idea is to sign next summer and stay with Denver for the rest of my career," Jokic told reporters in Serbian. After a FIBA World Cup qualifying game Monday night. "My idea and desire is to stay in Denver. I'll probably sign next year. My desire is to play the rest of my life in Denver." According to ESPN, Jokic became eligible for a five-year, $359.5 million contract in the summer of 2027, which would be the most lucrative deal in NBA history. That's enough for Jokic, age 31, to skip past the max extension he is currently eligible for, 4 years at $278 million. The center led the NBA in rebounding, 12.9 per game, and assists, career high, 10.7 per game, while scoring 27.7 points per contest in 65 games for the Nuggets in 2025-26. He finished runner-up in MVP balloting to Oklahoma City's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander for the second straight season after winning the award in 2021, 22, and 24. And the last item, Belgium trolls USA with "overturn this" post on social media. Belgium had their way with the United States during their round of 16 match in the World Cup on Monday. The Red Devils' official social media account even got in the act shortly after the team's 4-1 victory over the Americans. The site posted an image of striker Romelu Lukaku celebrating his goal with the caption, "Overturn this," an apparent reference to the availability of United States star Follerin Balogun. Balogun was cleared to play against Belgium after initially receiving a one-match ban following a straight red card against Bosnia and Herzegovina last Wednesday. He did not record a goal or an assist on Monday. President Donald Trump acknowledged that he called FIFA President Gianni Infantino to dispute the suspension, which only heightened the debate around the already controversial decision by the organization's governing body. The Belgian Federation was allowed to appeal, which it did, with the appeal denied on Monday morning. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Turning now to the opinion section of today's Arizona Republic, the first opinion: housing, gas, and health care are crushing young Arizonans. This is written by Yasemin Ansari, guest columnist. As gas prices climb and the cost of everyday essentials continues to rise, Arizonans are being squeezed from every direction. Working parents, seniors, families, and young people just starting out are finding it all harder and harder to afford rent, groceries, the air conditioning bill, health care, car insurance, or even just dinner out with friends. As the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus's Lowering Costs Task Force, I've spent the past several months listening directly to people of all backgrounds and income brackets in Arizona and across the country. Their message has been remarkably clear. The cost of living is completely crushing them, and that reality demands bold action that we can't delay. What has struck me the most is not simply the financial strain people are experiencing. It's the shame many feel when they can no longer afford the necessities, despite doing everything right and going the extra mile to do so. I've spoken with multiple people who have worked for decades, often juggling multiple jobs, and still find themselves struggling to pay rent, cover insurance premiums, or afford to insure their car. One Arizona resident recently told me his rent increased from $900 to $1,400 in 1 month. Stories like that are becoming far too common. While Donald Trump tries to use taxpayer dollars to build his ridiculous $600 million ballroom, the people in our district are suffering, forced to decide between paying for groceries or rent. Americans across the political spectrum are watching the Trump administration take fast actions, actions like starting a conflict in the Middle East that has driven gas prices through the roof. I know we need to act just as fast to improve lives for all Americans, not wait for the broadest possible consensus for legislation perfection. As the youngest woman in Congress, I know that young people are feeling the affordability crisis in a distinctly hopeless way, wondering if they will ever be able to afford or own a home, let alone how they will pay for health care, future child care, or ever be out from under the thumb of student debt. This year is America's 250th anniversary, and I know that the knee-jerk association is not always overly positive during these especially difficult times. But we should want to renew patriotism in this country, to rebuild our systems so they work for people who aren't billionaires, to live in an America where your enjoyment of life is not tied only to your income, an America my parents sought out when they immigrated here to build a better life for me and my brother. The American people are tired of hearing talking points while their lives get worse. Change is needed, now. That's why my Lowering Costs Task Force is working on a bold suite of bills to put more money back in Americans' wallets. Our bills tackle the biggest parts of most Americans' budgets, making things cheaper. Everything from prescription drugs, groceries, housing, utility bills, gas, and childcare. Here are some concrete examples. Making prescription drugs cheaper by establishing a government program to sell generic drugs at a discount. Making utilities cheaper by cracking down on for-profit utilities, overcharging consumers, saving the average family $500 a year. Making gas cheaper by charging big oil companies a tax on extra profits because of the war, then refunding that money to consumers. Making childcare cheaper by guaranteeing no family pays more than 7% of its income, under $10 a day for most families. Making housing cheaper by building millions of new homes, offering every first-time homeowner $20,000 in down payment assistance, and expanding rental assistance. Making groceries cheaper by cracking down on big grocers who fix prices and on companies that abuse seed patents to make farming more expensive. banning surveillance pricing, where companies use personal data to raise prices with AI. Putting money in pockets by requiring companies to pay double wages for overtime, as opposed to the current time and a half standard. Abolishing super PACs so millionaires can't buy more policies that make stuff more expensive. It's time to rebuild the American dream for this generation. A version rooted in dignity, belonging, and real power for real people. And if we want it to mean something again, we have to rebuild the systems underneath it so people feel represented, empowered, and connected again. We need a new American dream. And that was written by Representative Yasemin Ansari. She represents Arizona's 3rd Congressional District and serves as chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus's Lowering Costs Task Force. And the next opinion comes from Nicole Russell. She's a columnist with the USA Today Network. Of course Trump got FIFA to reverse a red card. Critics can smear Donald Trump for plenty of things, but they can never say he fails to advocate for American interest with a doggedness that borders on obsession. Even apparently when it comes to World Cup soccer matches, to the shock, chagrin, and perhaps even awe of much of the rest of the world. Trump said July 6th that he asked FIFA President Gianni Infantino to review a decision that had already sparked controversy at the World Cup. During the July 1 match against Bosnia and Herzegovina, U.S. striker Folarin Balogun was given a red card and banned for one game after stepping on his opponent's ankle. FIFA announced then, on July 5th, that it had rescinded Balogun's red card and would allow him to play in the U.S. men's national team on July 6th against Belgium. The Americans fell 4-1. "All I did was ask for a review. I didn't say you have to do this," Trump said from the Oval Office. "I didn't think it was a foul. I thought it was two great athletes that crashed into each other and got entangled. I didn't tell Infantino what to do. I can't tell him what to do," he added. The Royal Belgian Football Association filed an appeal of FIFA's decision to allow Balogun to play on July 6th, but it got rejected. Soccer fans were already upset about Balogun's red card and suspension. Now, Trump's call to Infantino has intensified scrutiny of the whole affair, igniting a firestorm of criticism for both FIFA and Trump. Critics suggest that Trump pressured Infantino, or that Infantino caved to Trump's influence, and that the president's involvement in a World Cup match is an unprecedented breach of both presidential norms and sports ethics on the world stage. CNN dubbed Trump's call a remarkable intervention that sparked a torrent of controversy at the World Cup. UEFA, Europe's soccer governing body, said FIFA crossed a red line and called the decision unprecedented, incomprehensible, and unjustifiable. Former FIFA president Sepp Blatter criticized both FIFA and Trump, posting on social media, "Red cards are not overturned by political phone calls. They are overturned by rules, evidence, and independent bodies. If a U.S. president intervenes with FIFA president and a player is suddenly cleared before a World Cup knockout match, the question is unavoidable. Quo vadis? Where are you going, FIFA?" Belgian politicians and soccer officials have also expressed anger and disappointment at FIFA. The New York Times reported that this is the first time FIFA has reversed a red card since 1962, adding that Mr. Infantino has spent years trying to curry favor with Mr. Trump. Last year, FIFA created and gave Mr. Trump the FIFA Peace Prize amid the president's public but failed campaign to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump, of course, was happy about FIFA's decision and applauded it on Truth Social, writing, "Thank you for FIFA for doing what was right and reversing a great injustice." Calling FIFA was on brand for Trump. "On one hand, I hope Trump didn't pressure Infantino to reverse the call. That would be unethical. I wish Trump would stay out of matters that don't require the direct involvement of the president. This one comes across like that parent at a youth soccer tournament yelling at the referee over a call involving their kid. It was already a bad call, and everyone knew it. Letting it go and watching Team USA win without him, without Balogun, would have been a win-win for everyone. On the other hand, I'm not surprised Trump watched the game, didn't like the call, and picked up the phone. That's just who he is. Infantino, for his part, could have said no. He didn't have to take the review seriously, let alone act on it. So if there's fault here, it runs both ways. Most of the outrage over this non-story says less about Trump than it does about how reflexively the world has learned to assume the worst of him. None of this should surprise anyone who's watched Trump for more than 5 minutes. He runs the presidency like a business he owns, not an office with boundaries. If something's broken, he wants it fixed, whether it's a soccer call or a crime wave. He tried to revitalize the unsightly Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool on the National Mall. He sent Immigration and Customs Enforcement into Minnesota to enforce immigration law. He's building a White House ballroom. So, is this Trump misusing his power, or just Trump being Trump? Both, probably, though I lean toward the latter. He watched a game, thought a call was wrong, and picked up the phone about it, same way he picked up the phone about crime in the nation's capital, or a park he thought looked run down. Whether that's a good habit in a president is a fair question. But it's not a new one, and it's not really about soccer. Love him or hate him, the man does not sit still, and a World Cup red card was never going to be the exception. That was written by Nicole Russell. She's an opinion columnist with USA Today. She lives in Texas with her 4 kids. And the final opinion, today's Arizona Republic, public funds shouldn't support private teachers' unions. This is a column written by Aaron Wythe and Justin Olson, guest columnists. Every time a state legislature takes up education reform, the response is predictable. Teachers' unions declare it as an attack on teachers and public education. But Arizonans should ask a straightforward question. Are these reforms actually bad for teachers, or are they bad for the unions that collect dues from them? There is a difference, and it matters. On June 12th, the Arizona legislature passed HCR 2040, and now voters will have the final say. Teachers' unions have spent decades building influence, electing sympathetic school board members, placing allies in administrative roles, and cultivating a political operation that makes them one of the most powerful forces in Democratic Party politics, favoring the farthest left option viable. The result is a system increasingly organized around protecting union prerogatives rather than serving students or the teachers who work with them every day. The union model is an us versus them dynamic, and that requires an enemy. In practice, it means administrators and school board members are cast as adversaries by teachers and the union. As an added layer of protection, the unions actively discourage direct communication between board members and teachers. It's a closed loop designed to keep teachers dependent on the union as their sole intermediary. This playbook doesn't just operate at the school level, it scales up. States that lean left tend to embrace the union model, in part because teachers' unions are among the largest political donors and organizing forces in the Democratic Party. Right-leaning states have increasingly pushed back with legislative reforms. And without fail, any measure the unions perceive as a threat, no matter how modest, triggers the same response. This is an attack on teachers. In Arizona, that influence shows up in ways most taxpayers would find surprising. Arizona school districts collect union membership dues through their payroll systems and distribute them to unions at taxpayer expense. Unions are permitted to enter schools, sometimes during the school day, to recruit members and campaign for political issues. New teachers are required to sit through union membership pitches at new hire orientation before they've taught a single class. Teachers are regularly flooded with district emails promoting union membership and political activity. Arizona school employees can legally go on strike. Unlike in the private sector, these strikes are entirely on the taxpayer's dime. Districts routinely code the authority to reward outstanding teachers because union contracts prioritize tenure over performance. HCR 2040 addresses each of these problems directly. It protects teachers' paychecks from automatic dues collection. It ends captive audience recruitment, drives on school time. It restores teachers' right to negotiate individually when they know they deserve more than a one-size-fits-all salary schedule that rewards years of service over classroom performance. And it stops requiring Arizona taxpayers to subsidize political organizations that use teachers as both a funding source and a constituency. HCR 2040 is now headed to the ballot this November. When voters weigh in, it's worth remembering that protecting teachers often means standing up to unions. That was written by Aaron Wythe. He's CEO of the Freedom Foundation, a nationally recognized union watchdog organization. Justin Olson is a Republican member of the Arizona State House of Representatives from District 10. And time now for the horoscopes for today. If you're in Aries, is romance in the air? Your energy and attitude attracts admirers as the Moon and Venus harmonize. For Taurus, do something relaxing, maybe even a little selfish, as the Moon and Venus harmonize. For Gemini, gift of gab? You're in the mood to yap as the Moon and Venus harmonize. Sharing is caring. For Cancer, making an appropriate business request? Ask and you shall receive as the Moon and Venus harmonize. For Leo, considering a costume change? Experiment with your look as the Moon and Venus harmonize. For Virgo, indulging in romantic nostalgia? As the Moon and Venus harmonize, you're imaging what was. Or what might have been. For Libra, looking for uncomplicated love? You'll get it as soon as the Moon and Venus harmonize. This cosmic weather delivers easy sweetness. For Scorpio, you won't feel much like working as the Moon and Venus harmonize. That's okay. Schmoozing can get you further now. Sagittarius, put work on pause as the Moon and Venus harmonize. Today is all about having fun. For Capricorn, don't be afraid to wear your heart on your sleeve today. A loved one needs to know you care. For Aquarius, pleasantly overstimulated? The way to your heart is through your mind, as Venus and the Moon harmonize. And for Pisces, making the right connections? Networking is your task, as the Moon and Venus harmonize. Seek out those who share your values. And time now for Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I've been married to my wife for 3 years. She asked me to fix her old computer. As I was doing that, I saw emails from her ex, Doug, dated a few months before our wedding. They started with the usual greetings, then proceeded to steamy back and forth emails. They set up a time to talk, and Doug suggested they use FaceTime. It appears they had several interactions on FaceTime. In his emails afterward, she told him never to text. He described his sexual feelings and details about what he was going to do to her. She played right back to him. This went on for about a month and a half. When she cut it off, he complained, but she never got back to him. Doug emailed her several times after the last interaction and asked why she had stopped, adding that he was giving up after receiving no response. I noted his number was also blocked on her phone. He lives in another country, so I know they didn't physically get together. We have a good marriage, but this is killing me. What should I do? Signed, Betrayed in New York. Dear Betrayed, what you should do is tell your wife you found her correspondence with Doug and how it made you feel. She realized she was making a mistake and ended her inappropriate conversations with Doug before she married you. I presume she's been faithful ever since. Feeling as you do, you may need the help of a licensed marriage counselor to put this matter to rest. Please, don't wait. And Dear Abby, my husband throws a fit over every minor inconvenience, from the trash can being knocked over to the screen door being in his way. He starts yelling and cursing and slamming doors. When things like this happen to other people, they simply pick up the mess or move the object and go about their day. I try to help and move stuff around to avoid his fits, but they are inevitable, it seems. I cannot handle the negativity over something so trivial. Our neighbors can hear him, and I'd feel embarrassed if I were him to be heard cursing like a child having a tantrum. How would you advise I handle this situation? I am at my wit's end. I feel as though I will have to live with this yelling and anger forever. Signed, In the Line of Fire. Dear In the Line, could there be some other stressors in your husband's life that have caused him to have such a short fuse? When folks are troubled about something they can't control, they sometimes blame their frustration on the nearest person or object. It's called displacement. I hope you realize that his inability to control his temper and his mouth is no reflection on you, and that it's not up to you to handle it. If you manage to catch him when he's rational, ask if anything else might be bothering him, and then be prepared to listen. If he realizes what's causing this, it might make him better able to cope. And if you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can reach her at dearabby.com. And we have time for a few comics. We'll start with Blondie. Blondie and his daughter are in the car. She's driving. And Dagwood's got all these little sweat beads coming off of him. And she says, "Relax, Daddy. You're a nervous wreck. You should be used to driving with me by now." He says, "Oh, I am." And then there are thought bubbles above him in the next frame that says, "That's why I'm so nervous." In Beetle Bailey, the general is in his office and he's holding a phone up to his ear and yelling, "I don't care if you want to do it. That's an order." And the Miss Buxley is talking to the other worker next to her and says and tells the other worker, "He ordered a pizza with pineapple and anchovies." And in The Born Loser, Thornapple is standing in front of his boss's desk, and his boss says, "I've completed your evaluation, and there's bad news and good news. The bad news is you lack self-confidence in your abilities. The good news is that shows excellent judgment." And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.